CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life. With Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makokotlela.
Dumela, Gary, and dumela to our guest today. And hey, it has been some time.
Yeah, it has. Mm-hmm. Today we have a two-part show, Lines. Our first segment has two parts.
Hmm.
First up, we talk about crooked lawyers that steal trust monies.
Oh, I've heard of those. Yeah. Those who live beyond their means and they put their hands in the cookie jar?
No, they shouldn't, Lions. Oh. On this one, we're joined by Jan de Beer, forensic executive with the Attorneys Fidelity Fund. Welcome to you, Jan.
Good afternoon.
It's a famous name, Jannie de Beer. Well, he was our famous scrum fly half.
Oh.
And he scored, I think it was a penalty. Was it a World Cup penalty? Do you remember that one?
Yeah,
which one was it?
It wasn't me.
Do you remember the penalty?
No.
I do. I just can't remember which match it was. Lionel wouldn't know. You wouldn't know that one, Lionel.
No, I'm not a rugby fan, but I watched the Bulls.
You watched the boys, Lionel. For the second part of the first segment, we discuss what happens if your lawyer is negligent and botches your case. And joining us on that one is Thomas Harbin. He's General Manager of the Attorneys Insurance Indemnity Fund. Welcome to you, Thomas.
Good afternoon, Gary.
How I got you, Thomas, is you write extensively in the lawyers' magazines, De Rebus, that most of our lawyers read. And I've picked up your articles. I read them avidly, and I wanted you in studio. Thank you for writing that stuff. Good for us lawyers to pick that up.
Thank you.
We need whatever we can get. Later in the show, after this first segment, we have another wicked story for you. We talked to the man who the police thought was a Nigerian drug lord.
Ooh.
And they raided his house, they smashed his property, they wrecked his reputation, and all along the man was innocent.
What?
Yeah.
It happens.
Sean Early is the man's name, and he'll be joining us later. Our email address, law@cliffcentral.com. Our Facebook page, The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg. Have a look at it and give us a like if you do. I'm sure you will. And, Lion, you want to do the Twitter handle?
Oh, yes. It's @HertzLaw, HERTZLAW. And if you can really recommend any shows that topics that you would like us to talk about, please do so. And please give us your feedback in terms of how we're doing.
Okay, so the first segment, as I said earlier, is divided into two. And first up in studio, Jan de Beer. He's a forensic executive with the Attorneys Fidelity Fund. And he's going to tell us how they tackle a crooked lawyer who's stolen your trust money. And it's horrific for us lawyers to hear that. It's a very prestigious profession. And we regard ourselves as someone special. We really do. And you can see from a number of lawyers the way they parade. But when a lawyer takes off with the client's money, it's heartbreaking.
It is. I mean, we are hearing a lot of this. I mean, yesterday the Minister of Health was actually talking about it on radio, where some lawyers who actually take money of clients and unrightfully so use that as their own money, and only to find that the clients end up suffering as a result. So there is just a lot of unethical conduct.
Yeah, I think what that story is about is the lawyer, the client, very often in rural areas may not really understand the process. Mm-hmm. So he thinks he's getting a million, which is a lot of money to him. Meantime, he's getting $5 million. And I think what the suggestion was is that the lawyer pockets $4 million, gives him the $1 million.
Exactly.
I don't know. I haven't proof of that, but I think that's what was suggested. Later in the second segment, we'll be talking to Thomas, who's an admitted attorney. He's a BA LLB from WITS, and he's currently the general manager of the Attorneys Insurance Indemnity Fund. And he's going to explain what happens if you suffer a loss when your lawyer is negligent, and it happens often. Your lawyer may well prescribe your claim. And do you have a claim against the lawyer? And that's what Thomas will talk to us about. Jan, while we have you on this one, it's an aside. You may know a little more than I do. Are lawyers, I don't think it's within your actual field, but lawyers get clients to sign for less than they're actually getting. And that was what the minister said. And it's a terrible one, that, isn't it?
It is not a good situation at all. What we do find, however, is that if one looks at the mandates concluded between clients and their attorneys, that there's not necessarily always a full understanding on the part of the client of exactly what it is that they're entering into in respect of acquiring those legal services.
Yeah.
And that, in a lot of instances, lead to confusion as well. But we also do find that as far as overreaching goes on the side of attorneys in respect of those fees, a lot of that could have been prevented if the consumer was, in fact, properly educated with regards to what I'm actually acquiring from.
Yeah, well, the lawyer is the one that should educate him and should say, I'm going for 5 million and this is what we're going for. We only got 3 million, but here it is in black and white. He has the release form, the insurance company or whoever sends us, and people sign it off. But I think they put their hands over it, the suggestion is, and the client doesn't know exactly what he's getting. But anyway, we've made that point. What I want to talk to you really about is last year, very disturbingly, I think it was in the Sunday Times, the headline was, and I quote it, it said, dodgy lawyers are stealing hundreds of millions of rands from their clients by looting trust accounts. That was in the press. And the report continued that the Law Society of South Africa had said, this was last year, that 49 lawyers had been struck off the roll in the previous year, and 24 of them had plundered, they used the word, trust accounts. Now, that's a very sad indictment on our profession, very sad. What are the latest stats?
If I look at the latest stats, and we see over the period of time, or the past 5 years, quite a significant increase in respect of claims against the fund. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, we just need to understand that in terms of the Attorney's Fidelity Fund, it's a client protection fund. So the consumers out there in terms of legal services need to clearly understand that the fund is there to actually step in and reinstate the confidence in the legal system. But at the same time, we do see quite an increase in respect of claims that has been notified to the fund in respect of a number of type of legal transactions. And we see that in respect of the previous financial year, that is from January to December 2016, those claims that has been notified is in excess of about 370 million rand for the year. At the same time, we're faced with a contingent claim position, in other words, those claims that we're still assessing at the moment, close to about 550 million rand that still needs to be assessed and looked at. Yes, we do see those increases in respect of claims, but we also see that the majority of the claims that we're receiving is also below a value of a million rand. Mm. That also talks to you about the nature of the transactions or the underlying legal transactions we're talking about, but it also talks to you about that consumer market as well, very much at the bottom end of the sector, and not necessarily finding ourselves that it's your sophisticated legal consumer out there that necessarily suffered the losses.
Jan, how many lawyers are involved in the latest statistics of having looted or stolen trust money?
In respect of that, we're probably looking at about just in the region of about 70, what we're referring to as defaulting attorneys. Mm-hmm. In other words, in terms of new defaulters coming into the system,
yeah.
In the past 12 months. And there, of course, if one looks at the recording of a defaulting attorney, those claims can, of course, come through to the fund over a longer period of
So these 70 lawyers are the lawyers that have taken money that doesn't belong to them. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
What we're looking at, that those are new defaulters that has been registered in our systems. In certain instances, those claims, of course, still need to be properly assessed as well.
Right.
Because we need to understand that under certain circumstances, the fund will not be able to cover those claims.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, if one referred to, for example, to attorneys that has been involved in the theft of investment monies in light of the investment practices that they operate.
Okay, we'll come to that. Let's just talk about the fund itself. So what this means is if a lawyer has stolen your money, if I can put it very simply, you can go to the attorney's fidelity fund and you lodge a claim. And you say, such and such a lawyer has stolen my money. Is that basically how it works?
That is how it works, but it also works very closely with the disciplinary processes on the side of the regulator, which is, of course, the law societies at the moment.
Okay, now, if it is shown that the lawyer has stolen your money, then you file a claim against the Fidelity Fund in the hope that you'll get paid the money that was stolen. Now, the Fidelity Fund is a fund that's been established, and how does it get its funding? Where does it get its money from to cover these claims of lawyers who have looted trust money accounts?
Yeah. The funding of the fund is primarily out of interest that is earned in respect of the trust accounts that are held by attorneys. Those are specifically in terms of the general trust account of the attorney and not necessarily the accounts in respect of where there is money is invested on behalf of the client.
Now, that's very interesting because very often as a lawyer, I've heard people say to me, Gary, you're holding on to my money. I want my money quicker. You're obviously earning the interest on my money. And I say to them, I don't get the money. The interest goes to the law society, ultimately to the Fidelity Fund. So the lawyers do not profit. And as long as the listener out there knows, the lawyers do not get any of the interest that's earned on the trust money.
That's absolutely correct, Gary.
Yeah.
The interest actually vests with the fund.
Yes.
The fact that it's paid over to the law society is purely just acting as an agent of the fund in respect of the collection of its primary revenue source itself.
Okay. Now, there are various ways that lawyers have taken money that doesn't belong to them. Some lawyers parade around as investment advisors or investment whatever, and they come along to people, especially the old and the frail, and they say, I can get you more money than you can get in the bank. So leave it in my trust account, give me whatever you've got, and I'll look after it, and I'll give you 12%, whatever it is. Now, assuming that to be the case, is the poor sod who gives the lawyer the money for an investment and the lawyer runs away with it, can they recover their money from the Fidelity Fund?
Gary, what we see is that there's quite a number of those claims coming through our environment, and it's very much a situation whereby the fund will unfortunately not cover those type of transactions. The principle is that, of course, yes, there must have been entrustment of the funds to the attorney, but also what is key, it must relate to the actual legal services that has been provided. So it's key that there must be an underlying legal transaction that must have been executed.
So today's a great warning, Jan. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Don't invest with an attorney on an investment. Because if he does something wrong, you will not get your money. It's not covered.
I think what is key is that we don't say that they shouldn't be investing, but I think it's important that the consumer should be aware of the risks that are associated with it. Those monies that are lying there as pure investments that are normally done in terms of the investment rules of the law societies will not necessarily attract the protection from the fund.
Okay, so now a lawyer does a transfer of my house. I sell it for $2 million. He gets the $2 million into his trust account, as an example, and he runs off with it. Is that covered?
What we're looking at is that in the event that as part of the conclusion of the property transaction or the transfer thereof, and the seller then do not actually receive their funds itself immediately out of the conclusion of that transaction, that of course would attract a claim against the fund.
Yes.
However, if the property transaction was concluded and the client requested the attorney to retain the funds, and not pay that to them immediately for whatever reason. There could be a situation that there's a change in mandate to that of holding that money on
as an investment,
which would then not attract the protection of the fund. So as long as that principle of that underlying legal transaction is not there anymore, there is a exposure on the part of the consumer that they don't attracting the protection.
Lawyers, that you make such a very, very interesting point, a distinction there, and we've got to, as the public, we just got to be careful that if once your transaction is registered, if you leave it with the attorney, it could be construed as an investment, and if anything should happen to that money, you're not covered by the fund.
Absolutely.
And that's cardinal. That's such important advice. Where lawyers are getting money into trust and maybe taking off with it is in what kind of cases? You mentioned conveyancing. Where else does it happen?
What we specifically see in terms of the claims that has been notified against the fund, there are three primary categories or classifications that we're looking at. The first of all relates to conveyancing transactions. And now there I specifically refer to the fact that it's conveyancing transactions, and I'm not necessarily emphasize the fact that it's conveyances.
Yes.
Because those monies can be held across all attorneys' trust accounts. Other component that we're seeing as such specifically relates to is monies that is held in respect of estate accounts within the attorney's environment, and then also matters that specifically relates to the road accident fund, where the attorneys are of course acting for those claimants as well. And I don't want to say that it's because of the nature of those transactions that it's necessarily causing alarm itself. What we need to keep in mind that if one looks at the distribution of funds that are actually held within attorneys' trust environments, in terms of rand values, those are the type of transactions that would naturally be of high value within the attorney's environment in any event.
Yes.
So it's difficult to say yes, but you will only steal the monies because it's a conveyancing transaction or because it is a road accident fund matter or a estate matter. The fact it is theft.
Yeah.
And we see that the distribution of the theft taking place across those type of monies is in relation to the makeup of those monies in total.
Jan, what happens to these attorneys that steal money and are still in South Africa? What happens to their estate? What happens to them as lawyers? Do they? You know, how does it work?
You would find that in most instances, you find that defaulting attorney would have been removed from the role, would not be able to practice.
That's
anymore.
An application to the High Court?
To the High Court.
To strike him off the role, that's what it's called.
That is
I don't know if you know this offhand. What happens to these lawyers? They're no longer attorneys as such. They're not on the role. But do they act as legal advisors in government or elsewhere? Do you know?
We do find that most definitely, that they're entering other parts of the provisioning of legal services that is not directly necessarily regulated itself.
Forgive me, like what? I mean, I may meet a guy who says he's a legal guy, but he's been struck off the roll. If someone has been struck off the roll, I can pick that up from the Law Society.
100%,
they'll
yes.
tell me.
They do find themselves probably entering the environment where they would probably practice with other attorneys, but not necessarily for their own account.
Okay.
They would enter the corporate environments. They would enter or still be involved in terms of providing legal services, but as consultants. And
they're legal advisors. They could be called legal advisors.
All consultants or different terminologies as such.
Yes.
But the key there for me is that the public also needs to understand that in terms of that, in terms of utilizing those services, in terms of dealing with a lot of those individuals, you would prefer that the public would require or request from that practitioner a verification in terms of their standing. And that would typically be a valid Fidelity Fund certificate that would provide them or give them some assurance in respect of the safeguards that are in fact provided.
Every practicing lawyer who is a director or owner of a business does have to have a Fidelity Fund certificate.
100% correct, yes. That is right.
There've been so many cases, I don't want to single out anyone. Just one I know in Benoni where it was reported all over the place there was one or two attorneys that stole an enormous amount of money. A lady of 80 lost 32 million. People lost their lives here. It's tragic, isn't it, when you see this? You get to see the people.
It is a sad situation. But also in that, I think what we provide is in fact that ability to in fact eventually or in our processes to make sure that those victims are properly compensated. But we also need to keep in mind that of course the fund is a fund of last resort as well. So it's unfortunate the situation whereby a claimant needs to go through certain processes first to recover the monies before we can step in finally. So it's not a situation that you submit your claim and immediately you get your money.
But it's unlikely they're going to get their money, or do some of them get the money out of the attorneys?
We do find in certain instances that is the case, but in terms of the discussion processes that are run at such, it's a long and a time-consuming process itself. The likelihood of recoveries in that in situations is very low. But then also in terms of the Act, we then also, after we've did in fact paid the claim, and in a lot of instances also compensated the claimant for the costs that they've incurred in respect of the discussion processes as well, we then of course step into the shoes of that claimant and make sure that we recover the monies from that defaulting attorney afterwards. But also what is key for us in respect of our processes is to make sure that there is a proper consequence in respect of the actions of that defaulting attorney. We go at great lengths in terms of cooperating and supporting the prosecuting authority, the investigating authority, making sure that in those instances there are proper cases opened. We support them with the right information to make sure that we can achieve a successful prosecution.
Do some of these attorneys actually land up in jail, or is it unlikely?
100% correct.
Oh, they do.
They do.
What kind of sentences have you seen being given?
We normally, in terms of our involvement with the prosecutor, would like to see that the minimum sentence of at least 15 years are imposed.
Do they get that?
We do see instances where that actually occurring. As recent as last week, we did find the successful conclusion of a matter whereby the practitioner was actually was sentenced of 12 years. But also we do see in a lot of instances that there are suspended sentences coming through as well. But also what we're trying to do where there is an opportunity then as well is to make sure that there is also a proper order of the court in terms of the recovery of monies if that opportunity does exist as well. And we then closely monitor the execution of those.
The question to be asked, Jan, is why do the attorneys do this? They know they're going to get caught out. What is it? Do they think they'll just fiddle it? They'll take and put it back because they're going to get money next week? Or why? I mean, you've obviously spoken to a number of these attorneys during the course of your forensics investigation. What is their excuse for doing this?
I think a lot of it relates to specifically if I look at certain of the profiles of the attorneys that we see where these occur, a lot of it is a lifestyle issue as well. It's a matter of how do I keep my business going as well, specifically those that are really battling of maintaining their practices as well. Suddenly they realize that we haven't done enough business this month and we have to pay the rent and we have to pay the salaries. And suddenly they find quick and easy access to client monies with the belief that the next month there will be money to substitute that. So where the right business decision would have been something totally different and not and still protecting your client's monies. So we see a lot of that. We also see in respect of the smaller value of claims coming through as it relates to risks of very small sole practitioners out there that are trying to establish their environments and growing their environments and also need to deal with understanding how this whole mechanism actually work or how do I actually run my small practice. And then they normally find themselves being tripped up by not necessarily knowing everything. Accounting for their fees incorrectly, haven't dealt with their transfers properly.
Well, whatever the case is, there's no excuse for this. Just the last from you, if I may, Jan, What is the warning we can give to the public? Feel free to deal with attorneys. I mean, this is these are not your everyday cases, but how does the public safeguard themselves? What should they do?
I think what is key for me is that, and it goes back to the function of the fund to really install the confidence for the consumer in terms of the utilizing legal services. Mm. I think what is key for the public out there is to make sure that they deal with a properly admitted attorney that's got a valid Fidelity Fund certificate. In that, I think it's key that the member of the public must ensure that it's don't just leave the financial transactions and believe that, yes, I've paid the money across to the attorney and it lies in their trust account. Mm. One need to ask for regular accounting in respect of those monies. It needs to take place. The practitioner is obliged to account to their clients accordingly. They need to ask those questions and deal with that appropriately. And if they believe something is wrong, it doesn't help that they wait for months and months to deal with it. They need to approach the legal regulator if they believe there are something that is untoward and deal with that on that basis. We're working closely together with the regulator in terms of that. But I think you need a proactive approach from the consumer to make sure that they actually do receive what they're paying for.
Very interesting. That's the voice of Jan de Beer of the Attorneys Fidelity Fund. He's a forensics executive. You hope never to see him because he only goes in when there's real KAK. Anyway, let's move on and let's talk to Thomas from the Attorneys.
I'm Thomas Harbin from the Attorneys Insurance Indemnity Fund, or the AIIF as is commonly referred to in the legal profession.
You write extensively, as I said earlier, in the magazines for us attorneys. This is what this one is all about. You are the man that we would come to if I was a member of the public where my attorney has negligently botched my case. The word botch may be wrong. He's negligently handled my case. For instance, he may have prescribed it without submitting a claim, and therefore I've lost my claim. I would come to, ultimately I'd land up with you and I'd say, I've lost my money because the lawyer was negligent. Now, Thomas, I want to draw a distinction. There's a distinction between negligence of an attorney or an attorney giving a wrong opinion.
Yes.
Address
the first part of your statement. Sure. As the member of the public, you wouldn't come to us. As an insurance company, our relationship is with the practitioner.
Yep.
So you would go to your attorney and say, Mr. Attorney, you haven't lodged my claim in time and therefore it is prescribed in your hands. You'll send the attorney a letter of demand and the attorney would come to us as the insurers and report it.
How much cover do you offer to the attorneys?
The cover is provided on a staggered basis, depending on the number of practitioners in a firm at the time. Between one and six partners, we provide cover of 1,562,500 rands, and it's staggered as with firms with a higher number of partners get a higher number of cover, with a maximum of just over 3 million rands for firms of 14 partners or more.
If my claim is larger, then most attorneys have a top-up, don't they?
That is
they have
correct.
Their own insurance, PI,
yes.
called PI,
yes.
Professional Indemnity.
Yes.
But if an attorney doesn't have cover, then the cover for him, if he's a sole practitioner, is about 1.5 million.
Yes.
Okay? And that's what I can recover from the attorney through yourselves, yes. ultimately.
Well, if for example, your claim is for 2 million rands,
yeah.
we'll pay our limit of just over 1.5 million. And the attorney will then need to find the balance out of their own pockets.
Now, I mentioned right up front, this is where an attorney has been negligent.
Yes.
What happens if the attorney gives me a wrong opinion? He says, your case is winnable. Meantime, it was never winnable. Can I sue him for negligence?
Yes, you can still sue an attorney in those circumstances. And often, attorneys, as with any other professional, can make a mistake while they're acting in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
And we often have claims where attorneys have given advice and it has later turned out that that the advice was incorrect, but they acted in good faith.
Do you pay out those kind of claims?
Yes, we do.
An attorney, on a surety, I come to an attorney and I say, I signed the surety. The attorney looks at it, he says, I think you can get out of this one. And we go to court and we lose. Can I sue him? He says, that was my opinion. Is he negligent?
What we need to look at, the standard that has been set out in a whole series of cases is that the conduct of the attorney needs to be judged against that of a reasonable attorney.
Absolutely.
The common reasonable man test has been altered in a number of cases to, if I could call it, a reasonable attorney test.
Right.
But if I could just to mention, Gary, at that point, a very small proportion of our cases actually arise out of attorneys giving incorrect advice. The vast majority of our cases arise out of attorneys failing to meet the basic standards that are expected of the profession.
Give us some examples of where attorneys have been negligent.
Yes. We have instances where attorneys have just been blatantly reckless, unfortunately. And for example, attorneys may fail to the most common type is failing to lodge a claim with the RAF timeously.
Mm-hmm.
Attorneys go to in certain instances we've seen attorneys' practices where something as basic as a diary does not exist. They therefore miss court dates. They miss dates by which actions are to be instituted, resulting in a professional indemnity claim against them. And in the last 10 years, we've seen a doubling in the number and value of claims against attorneys. And this is attributable to a number of factors. First of all, there is a lack of supervision of staff in the attorney's practices. We've had instances where conveyances have essentially left the running of their firms to the conveyancing secretaries without any supervision. And whenever I address attorneys, I always refer to an example of a practitioner from Vanderbijl Park who walked into our office one day to notify us of two claims worth 400,000 rands each. And when we asked him what was going on in this practice, he said he didn't have time to deal with his practice as he needed to be out there being the rainmaker. Another reason for the increase in claims is that as other areas of the law, for example, road accident fund related claims appear to be drying up, practitioners have looked to other areas of law. You've seen it with the increase in medical malpractice claims, and in the same way that they are suing each other.
Yeah.
And also we need to note that the public have become more aware of their rights. Gone are the days where what your lawyer said was the gospel and that could not be challenged. And lastly is the growth in the profession. About 8 years ago, there were approximately 18,000 attorneys in South Africa. As we sit today, there are just over 24,000. And the reality is that the cake hasn't grown, gotten bigger. So people need to find some or other way to make money, and on the one hand, it has led to some practitioners taking their eye off the ball in their practices, but on the other hand, other practitioners finding it necessary to sue them.
I saw an interesting little article somewhere. I think it was in the Lawyers Magazine, De Rebus, which I read religiously monthly, and I hope it doesn't stop being published.
It will continue with the funding from Jan's organization, the fund.
Good. They did some kind of, with LexisNexis, they conducted a national survey of the attorney's profession, and the sample showed that while the profession is still a male-dominated industry, almost 40% of the people they canvassed were female, which is, the women are getting up there, and 60% of the attorneys are still white. Those are the stats they revealed.
Yes,
and things are changing as we go along.
Yes, and also something else in terms of the breakdown of the profession, you find that probably approximately 70% of practitioners are single practitioners.
Yes.
In the country.
I wonder why that is, because they need help. They could lean on one another. Maybe that's why there's so many claims.
Yes, that's probably. And there are a number of services available to the profession, which, for example, our organization provides them with the insurance at no cost. Mm. And this service is a unique service internationally. We've traveled around the world. We haven't come across another profession that gets insurances
for free,
at no cost. Yes.
How long has this been in for?
Since 1993.
And prior to that, you had to have your own insurance
company? Prior to that, there was it was run as a scheme, which was administered by various insurance companies and brokers, including Glenrand MIB, which was involved from 1986 until 1993.
Gents, before I let you go, is there anything you'd like to add? Jan de Beer, anything you would like to mention before we go?
I think it's important that we emphasize the role of the fund in this specific environment. We need to understand that we are client protection fund itself. We're there to make sure that the consumer is properly protected. It doesn't mean that we, if we're part of the legal profession itself, it doesn't mean that that's an easy way out for that attorney that is not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And there are definite consequences in respect of their actions. And we've been dedicated resources specifically in that environment. And then there is an appropriate deterrent that is required in respect of that, considering the increased nature of increased claims in our environment.
Yeah.
So from my side, it's important that the public understand the functions of the fund, the role of the fund, what it's playing in respect of the overall society and the environment, and the important contribution it makes in respect of the overall legal system to instill confidence.
Thank you, Jan de Beer. We're running out of time, or we've run out. Jan de Beer, Attorneys Fidelity Fund. Thomas Harbin, before you go, anything you want to add that I may not have covered
for, for the members of the public, when you instructed an attorney, please ask the attorney what internal controls they have. That will safeguard your money in terms of theft, and that will also ensure that the attorney will carry out your instructions properly. And also, please be careful. If you'll note from our various publications and our website, in recent years, attorneys have lost 83 million rands by falling victim to cyber scams. Mm. And to put it briefly, essentially, the attorney receives an email purporting to be from the client, instructing them to change the banking details.
Yeah, no, so
please,
that, yeah.
Yes, tell your attorney that you will only instruct them to change banking details in person, and that they shouldn't fall to your email.
Lance, anything you want to add? Well, thank you, Thomas.
Oh, yes, I just want to ask this one question. Does the cover also work in the pro bono instances where people are actually taking matters on pro bono, but they don't put as much effort into that?
Well, if you went to an attorney like Gary and in his pro bono hours he handled your instruction, certainly we would cover it, because the payment of the fee is not a requirement.
It's a very good question.
Yes.
If a pro bono attorney is negligently messes up your case, you've got a claim against him. Doesn't matter what it is. Yeah.
Yes.
If he doesn't lodge your claim and it prescribes, you've got a claim against him, and ultimately the fund would cover that up to the amount.
Yes, the attorney's duty is the same for a pro bono client as for a high fee paying client.
Yeah, Lionel's not just a pretty face; he's smart as well, with an MBA that I see.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, gents, very very much. Thomas Harbin, thank you very much. Jan de Beer, we'll talk to you again. This has been great, and very enlightening for me and for the public, I'm sure. Appreciate it. Let's have, before you go away, guys, I just want to mention we have a very interesting show that's coming up, a wicked one right now. It's going to be on a separate podcast. It's about the man who the police thought was a Nigerian drug dealer, and they smashed up his house and they wrecked his reputation. He's coming into studio right now. We're going to move on. We're going to break for a moment, and then he'll be in studio. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
CliffCentral.com.